April 4th, 1974 was a cold spring day in Wichita, Kansas, and the day that Dennis Rader, known as BTK, decided to complete his next project, as he referred to his murders. His first killings of the Otero family, which he called Project Little Mex for young Josephine, were less than 3 months prior, but he now had a taste for it. Believing the chaos of the Otero's murders was the reason he didn't feel satisfied, Rader felt that if he could ensure things went according to plan with Catherine Bright, which he called Project Lights Out, he could satisfy his hellish urges and possibly quit his deadly pastime. Not only did things not go according to plan, but an unexpected victim also escaped after being shot twice in the head and almost shooting him with his own .357 Magnum pistol. Besides a lust for killing, there is one other thing Dennis Rader had in abundance: ego. 6 months after Catherine Bright's murder, three men confessed to her killing and the attempted murder of her brother Kevin. Rader decided that he'd be damned if someone else was going to take credit for his hard work, so he made himself known to the authorities by contacting a local newspaper, which began a game of cat and mouse that lasted 30 years. Welcome to part two of our coverage of Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. Join us on our journey as we explore the demented actions of a seemingly normal family man, devoted member of his church, and public servant on season two of The American Serial Killer Guidebook. Dennis Rader liked to spend his spare time cruising the streets of Wichita, Kansas, and the surrounding metro looking for victims in what he called his trolling phase. Once he identified someone as a potential project, he entered his stalking phase, which is when he would begin focusing on that person, attempting to identify their schedule, vehicle, residence, and precisely who did or did not live with the victim. In an effort to ensure he didn't have another instance of unwanted males to deal with, Rader stalked 21-year-old Catherine Bright for weeks and finally determined she was single and lived alone, making her a perfect target. Thinking himself clever, he decided to switch things up to throw off the investigators. He chose not to cut the phone line and didn't bring any cord like he used on the Otero family, choosing to use what he found so as not to risk leaving any outside evidence. After repeatedly knocking on Catherine's door and receiving no answer, he walked around back and made entry by breaking the glass on her back door. Realizing no one was home, Rader used his time to look through the house, going through cabinets, closets, and drawers to learn more about his victim. Less than an hour after entering Bright's home, Dennis Rader heard a car pull up and the door close. He quickly hid in the front bedroom, hearing the front door unlock and someone enter. He excitedly leaned against the wall by the bedroom door, expecting only Catherine. But he was surprised when not only Catherine, but her 19-year-old brother Kevin walked by, which is when he pointed his weapon, telling them to hold it right there. Since he wasn't expecting to leave any survivors, Rader used the same line as he did with the Oteros to get Catherine and her brother to comply. He told them he was a wanted criminal on the run from California, and all he wanted was some food, money, and a car to get to New York. The Brights had no reason not to believe him, so they decided the sooner they did what he said, the sooner he would be gone, and the entire nightmare would be over. Little did they know that the nightmare was only just beginning. Rader handed Kevin some rope and told him to tie up his sister in the back bedroom, while holding him at gunpoint, then told him to go into the next bedroom where Rader tied him with his feet to the bedpost so he couldn't run away, before turning up the radio to cover any noise. Rader then went into the other room and came back with a knotted pantyhose and began strangling Kevin Bright. But the bindings weren't strong enough and Bright wasn't going down easy, so he broke his bonds and began to fight with the man attempting to take the lives of him and his sister. In the struggle, Bright managed to put up a hell of a fight, but then Rader pulled out his .22 caliber pistol and shot Kevin in the forehead. Seeing the impact hole and blood spatter, Rader believed Kevin Bright was dead, so he turned his attention to young Catherine in the next bedroom. Rader began strangling Catherine Bright, but once again his bindings were too weak, and he had underestimated her will to survive. Catherine began fighting for her life, but unfortunately Dennis Rader was able to overcome her by punching and choking her unconscious, which was the same time he heard movement in the next room. Thinking she was dead, Rader went to check on Kevin, deciding it was best to strangle him again to make sure he was finished, but Kevin, playing dead, jumped up and attacked Raider again, only this time he managed to grab Raider's .357 Magnum from his shoulder holster and pulling the trigger twice. The first time the gun jammed, and the second time, Raider managed to jam his finger between the hammer and the firing pin, stopping the weapon from firing. Once again, Raider pulled his .22 caliber pistol and shot Kevin Bright, only this time it hit him in the face just above the right side of his mouth. Thinking him dead for sure this time, Raider returned to the next bedroom where Catherine Bright, having regained consciousness, began fighting for her life once again. Realizing that strangling her was not going to work, Raider pulled out a knife and stabbed her multiple times in the abdomen and back, angled up under her ribs, thinking he had finally taken her life. That's when Dennis Raider heard the front door open. Thinking it was the police coming in, having heard the gunshots, he walked into the living room, seeing Kevin Bright running towards the street. Raider quickly cleaned up the scene and went outside to steal their pickup, but he had the wrong set of keys. Rather than risk trying to locate the correct set, he grabbed his things and ran east towards the Wichita State University campus where he left his car and disappeared. Kevin Bright ran into two men. One called the police before they drove him to the hospital, where he was placed in intensive care after narrowly avoiding becoming the sixth victim of BTK. Catherine managed to crawl to the living room, which is where police found her lying in a pool of blood. She was taken to the same hospital as her brother, where 5 hours later, she finally succumbed to her wounds during surgery. I pride myself on not just regurgitating what other journalists and podcasters have put out on the internet about BTK, so it took me a while. I know this is an older serial killer. A lot's been covered on him, but I wanted to wait until I actually got my hands on the police reports from the Wichita, Kansas Police Department. The following is the official police report from investigators on the day that they found Catherine Bright and interviewed her brother Kevin. On April 14, 1974, Wichita Police Department officer Dennis Landon was dispatched to 3210 East 17th Street at 2:05 p.m. on the report of a possible shooting victim. While en route, Officer Landon was notified that an ambulance was being dispatched to the location. Officer Landon arrived in the area at 2:08 p.m. and determined that the address of 3210 East 17th Street was a mistake. Officer Landon approached the address of 2317 East 13th Street and knocked at the screen door. The front door was open. After receiving no response, Officer Landon looked in through the open door and saw a female lying in a pool of blood. The young woman was found clutching a telephone in her hand. Officer Landon found her at the back of the house outside of a bedroom. Officer Landon turned her over to see her injuries. She was asked what happened but was unable to respond. When asked if she was hurt, she pulled up blouse, exposing her abdomen. Officer Landon noticed three possible knife wounds. The young woman said she did not know her attacker. She was able to give her name, Catherine Bright, and her age, 21, before beginning to pass out. Officer Landon got a cloth from the kitchen and applied the cloth to her wounds. The officer noticed nylon stockings tied to her wrists. A blue scarf and a thin rope or cord was tied loosely around her neck. Her right hand clutched a white rag. A nylon stocking was tied tightly around her ankles. Bright said she could not breathe and asked the officer to untie her legs. Officer Landon used his pocket knife to cut the stocking tied around her ankles. Officer Landon notified dispatch of his need for an ambulance and elevated Bright's legs. Officer Raymond Fletcher arrived and assisted in attending to Bright. Upon his arrival, Officer Fletcher noticed that Bright was covered in blood. In addition to the pool of blood underneath her waist, Bright had blood on her hands, in her hair, and on her face. Officer Fletcher noted that she was bleeding from her left nostril and her face was badly bruised. The officers tried to calm Bright by telling her an ambulance was on the way and that she would be all right. At this time, Bright showed no reaction in the pupils of her eyes, and her breathing became shallow. Bright grabbed Officer Fletcher's arm and repeated, "I can't breathe, help me." Bright was cold and clammy, and her face had a bluish hue. After the Metro ambulance took Bright to Wesley Medical Center, Officer Landon and Officer Fletcher walked through the house. Underneath a small green table in the entry room, Officer Landon noticed a clutch bag or purse with the contents strewn on the floor. The radio in the living room was on. In the front bedroom, Officer Fletcher noticed a green chest of drawers. The top drawer was open and contained women's underwear. The princess phone in the room had been disconnected from the wall. The radio in the room was on. A pair of shirts tied to a nightgown were found near the closet. The nightgown was saturated with blood. Two teeth were on the nightgown. A red piece of clothing was tied to the bed. A green piece of clothing was tied to the red clothing. The door to the connecting bathroom had a bullet hole consistent with a small caliber weapon. The officers documented a hole in the linoleum floor of the bathroom. Bits and pieces of a .22 caliber or small caliber bullet were found near the door jamb of the opposite bathroom door that connected to the back bedroom. Bright was found in a pool of blood outside of the back bedroom. A turquoise cushioned chair was in the doorway of the back bedroom. Nylon stockings were tied to the arms of the chair. The chair contained a large pool of blood. The back door of the house opened into the kitchen. The glass to the back door was broken out and had been swept up against the door. Officer Fletcher interviewed William Williams and Edward Bell. Williams and Bell had seen a young man running from the house toward Hillside. The young man was bleeding from the head. The young man said he had been shot, and he's in there now doing a number on my sister. Please help me. One of the men called police, and then Williams and Bell rushed the young man to Wesley Medical Center. Detective Lloyd Simmons found a plastic cord in the front seat of an old Chevrolet pickup truck that was parked directly east of the home on Holyoke. The cord was stained with blood and was found next to a stocking cap. The truck was registered to Charles Bright, the father of Catherine Bright. Wichita Police Officer Ronald Davenport responded to Wesley Medical Center, arriving between 2:10 p.m. and 2:15 p.m. Chief of Hospital Security Arnold Davis was in an emergency room with 19-year-old Kevin Bright. Davis advised that Bright had been shot twice in the head and arrived at the hospital with a white cord tied around his neck. Davis had removed the cord. Later, in another emergency room, Officer Davenport observed Catherine Bright. Bright had a scarf and a white cord tied around her neck and entangled in her hair. Medical personnel were busy treating Bright, but Officer Davenport observed 5 stab wounds in the abdominal area. When Bright was turned over, Officer Davenport saw 2 more stab wounds on her back. Officer Davenport heard Bright say, "Help me." Eventually, Bright was taken to surgery, and she died there. Lab investigator Ron Eggleston observed Kevin Bright in the hospital. Eggleston was informed that ropes had been tied around Bright's neck had been removed. Eggleston observed that Bright had 2 gunshot wounds to the head. One wound was to the right upper lip. Powder burns were visible around the wound. The other wound was to the right forehead. Bruising was visible on the cheek and neck, and rope marks were visible on the neck. Bright was conscious but in pain and had difficulty speaking. Detective Jerry Fraypoint, Officer David Worry, Officer Davenport, and Arnold Davis interviewed Kevin Bright in the emergency room. Bright was being treated by medical personnel, and the conversation was stopped several times due to Bright choking up blood. Bright was eventually taken to intensive care, but later that day gave a taped statement to Detective Darrell Oakley and Captain Al Stewart. Bright said that he lived in Valley Center but was staying at his sister's house the night of April 3, 1974 due to snow. Mr. Bright told the officers that he and his sister were confronted by a white male with a gun when they entered the home at approximately 12:30 p.m. The white male came out of the bedroom and said he was not going to hurt them. The man said he was from California or wanted in California and needed money and a car to get to New York. Mr. Bright described the man as 25 years of age, 5 feet 11 inches tall, 180 pounds with a stocky build, light complexion, and mustache. The man was wearing a black stocking cap, a windbreaker, and an army coat with possible fur around the hood. Mr. Bright said that the man was wearing a silver wristwatch on his left arm. The watch had an expansion band. The gun was described as a black .22 automatic. The man wore gloves and was sweating profusely. The man ordered Kevin Bright and his sister into a bedroom. Bright was forced to tie his sister's hands behind her back. Bright was then taken into another room and tied up by the man. The man asked for money and Bright gave him $3. The man left the room and Bright heard the man tell his sister that he had found $10. The man came back into the room and put a stocking around his neck. Bright believed that the man was going to choke him, so he struggled loose and grabbed what he believed to be the man's finger. The man pulled a gun from his pocket and shot him. Bright never lost consciousness. Later, the man kicked Bright to see if he was dead. Bright said he heard his sister cry out in pain at times. In the home, Detective Richard Cook found a .22 caliber cartridge casing in the front room of the house. The .22 caliber cartridge casings were removed from the closet in the front bedroom. At the St. Francis Morgue, Lab investigator Eggleston observed Catherine Bright. Bright's face was badly swollen and discolored. The eyes were blackened and her face was covered with petechial hemorrhaging. A dark area was visible on her left jaw and neck. Bright's shoulders and right ear were bruised. Ligature marks were visible on her neck, wrists, and ankles. At the autopsy, Dr. William Ecker identified 11 stab wounds to the right front and left back of Bright. Bright's larynx was damaged. The cause of death was determined to be multiple stab wounds and strangulation. 6 months after Catherine Bright's murder and the attempted murder of her brother Kevin, 3 men were arrested and they confessed for those crimes. But it wasn't them. And Dennis Rader, he was none too happy. He wasn't about to let these guys take credit for all of his work. I mean, he almost got shot with his own gun. You know, he had to fight all these people. He wasn't going to let someone else take credit for that. Not after what he considered winning or putting them down. No, he had to set things straight. So, this is from the police report of his first contact with authorities. On October 22, 1974, Don Granger of the Wichita Eagle and Beacon newspaper received a telephone call from an unidentified individual informing him that a message regarding the Otero homicides was in a book in the Wichita Public Library. Granger relayed the information to the Wichita Police Department. Detective Bernie Drawatsky of the Wichita Police Department recovered a 2-page typed document from a textbook entitled Applied Engineering Mechanics. The document contained 1. A statement of responsibility for the Otero homicides and information to support the claim of responsibility. 2. An attempt to explain a motivation and rationale for the murders. 3. A codename of BTK derived from the words bind them, torture them, kill them. Law enforcement had arrested 3 men for the Otero murders. The author stated, "Those 3 dudes you have in custody are just talking to get publicity for the Otero murders. They know nothing at all." The author claimed sole responsibility for the murders. "I did it all by myself and with no one's help." That sounds like something a little kid would say, didn't it? "I did it all by myself with no one's help." In support of the claim of responsibility, the author stated, "Let's put it straight," and gave a description of the murders in the scene. The author stated that the kids making lunches before Josephine was murdered by hanging by the neck and Joseph Jr. was suffocated with the old bag trick. The author casually stated Otero's watch missing. "I needed one, so I took it. Runs good." The author claimed to be controlled by a monster and warns that more victims will follow. Finally, the author gave himself a name, writing, "The code words for me will be bind them, torture them, kill them. BTK. So, he talks about being able to do it all by himself and then using code words. I mean, this guy has kind of a childish mentality for a serial killer. But then again, serial killers never really were attributed with extremely high intelligence. Well, a couple here and there, but definitely not Dennis Rader. It's obvious by the lack of empathy and the matter-of-fact style in which Dennis Rader claimed responsibility for the Otero murders, not to mention he continued to brutally murder innocent people, that BTK was a heartless monster who would stop at nothing to satisfy his need to kill. It's only by sheer luck and Rader's inexperience that Kevin Bright didn't share the fate of his sister Catherine. But as he continued to kill, Rader made sure that he would never leave behind another adult survivor. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of our multi-part coverage of BTK, and join me for the next episode where I'll cover Shirley Vian, whom Rader stripped, bound, and murdered while her children were locked in the bathroom next to the bed just a few feet away. I'm Elton Morgan, and this is Season 2 of The American Serial Killer Guidebook.